session number 21564, reel 10.
Colonel Cormack, reel 10.
I think you were saying that the military police were responsible for traffic control and putting up tactical signs. Did you have very much contact with them while you were in Korea?
Not a great deal, but we saw firsthand what they were doing, and it was absolutely invaluable for finding your way around, until newcomers particularly, until they got used to the tactical signs and for locations of units and subunits. But they were exceptionally good at that, and traffic control on key points, and particularly bridges where necessary. And I think it became obvious to all that their role was of considerable importance in operations, as opposed to the purely policeman-type role with red caps on that most of them had suffered, if you like, in Aldershot and other garrison towns, when they were seen as people to be avoided at all costs, or with their presence meant trouble. In operations like Korea, they came into their own and were absolutely invaluable from that point of view, and earned considerable respect from all because of that.
You were saying earlier on that once the lines had been established after Operation Commando, that there was a great deal of artillery bombardment by the Chinese of our defensive position.
Both sides, yes.
Yes, yeah, so we were bombarding them, they were bombarding us. Did you get heavily involved in repairing damage to frontline positions caused by bombardment?
Up to the time I left, yes, we did. I have to say that it became much more serious afterwards. I mean, the battles of the first battle of the Hook in November, I remember, the Duke of Wellington's Battle of the Hook. Again, in 1953, I had gone. That was when they really suffered from tremendous Chinese artillery bombardment, and the damage to field defences was quite exceptional. And from pure field defences, then they had started with us, but the tunnelling aspect became even more important after. But that's after I left, and I wouldn't like to comment on second hand, as it were.
Did you get involved in tunnelling at any stage?
No, that wasn't my experience at all. There was a little bit at divisional headquarters,
yes,
but I wasn't involved in that. It was my field defence experience was fairly straightforward, slit trenches, and communication trenches, that sort of thing, and the wire associated, which I mentioned before, and various minefields that we were involved in.
Do you know if at any time it was thought it might be advantageous to construct concrete blockhouses and pillboxes, things of that sort?
That evolved. I mean, as the artillery battles became fiercer and the weight of artillery fire increased, it was realised that timber box and beams, however well put in, were much more vulnerable, and there was a gradual transition to precast concrete beams, which could then be brought up and then put in place. That was a fairly gradual process, which increased and certainly came into its own about the time of the second Battle of the Hook.
But that was after you'd gone?
After I'd gone.
Yes, yes.
And our field supports, in fact, they were the field park squadrons in those days, they had a fairly good manufacturing capacity. And they made all sorts of things in quantity, and then cutting timber up. The Canadians were particularly adept, and that they ran a special timber lumber camp, if you like, when timber beams were the order of the day, and that was for a considerable period. But the field park squadrons, they would produce the precast concrete beams as required, and almost anything that you needed that was slightly unusual, they would produce. I mean, for example, when we were mine laying, and our anti-personnel mines were usually those with tripwires, and you had to put a peg in the ground to hold the tripwire in place. It was found that in the winter, as the ground froze and froze very hard, that timber pegs couldn't be used effectively, so they manufactured masses of metal ones. and then all you had to do was to learn how to hammer those in without making too much noise. But that was a little example of what they could turn their hand to, and concrete blocks and beams became the order of the day.
Do you know how they did that? Did they bring their own plant with them into the theatre, or did they use local Korean plant and resources to produce these things?
I really don't know. I would think they would they would set up a system of shuttering, and all you want is a concrete mixer,
yes,
or a cement mixer, and then you could make your shuttering from local timber and materials, which would be a sort of routine supply, and then set up a little chain, of like almost like a factory, and then you would pour your blocks one after the other, then they would set, and then you would carry on pouring, and then as they were set and then ready for use, and the cement or concrete was cured properly, then they were transported forward, and they would have an ongoing system like that. That's how I imagine it would have been.
So like an in-the-field production line?
Yes, exactly, yes.
Yeah. Presumably they had some trouble doing that in the very cold weather, because doesn't concrete tend to be difficult to handle in extremely cold conditions?
Yes, that is right. And all sorts of things can be done to stop the concrete freezing before it's set, and make it easier to move. And yes, that was, I can't say from my own experience how they got round that difficulty, but I can remember, reverting to my gravel pit, for example, that when we got the stuff out of the river onto the bank and the heaps there, when the weather got very, very cold, it froze. Mm. And we had to resort to mixing it with chemicals, and on one or two occasions actually pouring fuel over it and setting fire to it, so that we could actually manage to handle the gravel.
That's an extreme measure, isn't
that's
it?
That's an extreme measure.
Burning
but that's
fuel to unfreeze gravel.
Yeah. It was so extreme. Mostly it was sort of chemicals that would generate heat,
yes,
which you mixed up with it, and that kept the heat from freezing. Mm. But you had to learn by experience, and people hadn't actually thought heaps of gravel will freeze solid and therefore can't be used as part of the initial planning. Then the trick was to improvise and suggest answers, and a lot of very good brains around the sappers, and one or two of them were civil engineer experience, came up with these ideas. And
fuel is something that is obviously essential. Did you have connections with the resupply of fuel?
No.
You didn't.
That was entirely outside our experience. Yeah. That came up with the RASC and the ordnance people. That's how that came up, and we were not involved in fuel. The only thing you would do was to collect fuel.
Yes. I was wondering if at any time anyone had thought of perhaps laying a pipeline as a means of delivery rather than relying upon motor transport with cans.
I can't honestly say if that was considered or not, but the jerry can supply system did actually work quite well.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the same as running a water point. I mean,
yes,
we supplied that, we had the water, and we supplied a point where you could fill your tank, your water tank, or you could fill your water jerry cans.
Yes.
You had a tap for that. We would have a collection of fuel jerry cans for diesel and petrol, and my troop sergeant organized that, and a truck would go up, and you would virtually have a truck full of empties on the way, a truck's worth at your squadron base, and a truck being filled up, and there was a continual flow round. That was the general principle.
A shuttle system.
Yeah. And it worked very well. We were never without fuel. In fact, we had plenty of it for when we experimented with the foo gas, as I may have mentioned before. Then you could ask for diesel, or you could ask for napalm, which was only used offensively. But that general logistic background, at my level, one did tend to take a bit for granted once you knew the system. And my troop sergeant, as he was then, was exceptionally good at that, as a routine drill, collection of fuel, collection of rations, collection of water we ran ourselves. That worked very well overall.
Was he responsible for all the paperwork and administration of that sort, or did you have to get involved in signing indents? And
there wasn't a lot of paperwork.
There wasn't a lot of paperwork.
That was kept the absolute minimum, absolute. And it was just the indents were signed. He would bring them for signature, and a quick check. But I mean, he was reliable. We had a good team. I didn't have to worry about that. If I wanted ammunition, explosives, mines, that was indented for. In the same way, if I wanted beehives for special explosive work, we simply demanded those through squadron.
What are beehives?
They were shaped explosive charges. And it's rather like the old-fashioned beehive, the beekeeper one in the woods, a dome-shaped structure,
yes,
metal, full with explosives on legs. And you just, a detonating place at the top, ran a length of detonating cord in, ran it out to a firing point somewhere away, and you fired this, and it was a cone-shaped thing with an inverted cone like that, and that formed a metal slug which blew with tremendous power. It was used for blowing holes in things, particularly metal, which you then had to fasten either vertically or horizontally. We used to use it for breaking up extremely hard ground, or where it was rocky ground, stone, for breaking up that so that my little D4 could then get its blade underneath the shattered parts and lift it, because some of the boulders and rocks in the ground were just too big to move, and explosives were the way. And the beehive was a very good, and if when they were available, a quick way of making a hole or shattering the rock, as opposed to getting a pneumatic drill up and drilling holes and then putting explosives in, tamping it down.
When you were doing this sort of work, demolition work essentially, were you using chemical detonation or electrical detonation?
Electrical. Yeah. We mostly electrical, but we had, for small operations, we had these detonating cord, safety fuse, and a little match fusee, we called it,
yes,
which would light under almost every weather condition, which you then set fire to the safety fuse. Mm. I mean, for using beehives or explosives on road construction, it wasn't necessary to set up an electrical system. That would be mainly for pre-planned bridge demolition, a major operation. Sometimes in quarry work, but mostly we just used the detonating cord, safety fuse, and the match fusee chain.
Was plastic the main explosive you used? Yes. And did you use any other sort of explosive?
Most plastic was almost all the stuff we used, yes. Mm. PE2 it was then. 808 was available, and we had that, but we were happy for that to waste out because it tended to, if you had to handle it, you tended to get a headache from handling the 808, the aminol, I think it was, after handling or moulding it for quite a bit, you tended to get headaches, which could be quite awkward. But that was a common fault of the early plastic explosives. The PE2 was much better.
Didn't do that to you then? No, no headaches with PE2.
Yeah, that was okay. It was much easier to handle. And the great thing about those plastic explosives is that they were relatively inert. That if you were hit by, if they were hit by a bullet or a piece of shrapnel, they wouldn't blow up.
Would they burn? Could they burn?
Yes, off? They burned. They yes. burned exceptionally well. But you had to give them quite a kick with a primer and a detonator.
Yes.
The primer's a little plastic thing.
Yes.
With a hole through it, and you put the primer into the explosive, then put the detonator in with the safety fuse attached, and that gave it the kick to set it off.
So it would really be a sort of three-stage process, wouldn't it? The
yes.
safety fuse, the detonator, the primer, and then the main charge.
The main charge.
Would go. Would that be virtually instantaneous?
Oh, yes. Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. It had the detonating cord had a fairly rapid rate. The safety fuse, which we tested, had a burning rate of so many feet a minute, and you knew what that rate was. And it depends on how long a piece of safety fuse you're going to use.
Yes.
But whatever you did, you cut a length off, a foot length off, and burned it and timed it to make sure that the reel wasn't faulty. Nothing worse than expecting the safety fuse to burn for 3 minutes and go up after 30 seconds. So you did these little simple precautions.
Did you ever have any accidents with the use of explosives?
No, I didn't, no. I mean, I think there were some, but there weren't very many of those. The training was good, and they were basically fairly straightforward once you'd been trained at common sense. And as long as you didn't get too overconfident, they were pretty safe. I don't recall accidents out there. There have been accidents in explosives, yes, I know. But that was either carelessness or
not following procedure.
Yeah.
You were saying earlier on that on some patrols you went out with the infantry and you'd be used to help them to attack Chinese defensive positions or demolish them after they'd been taken. What sort of charges would you take with you for that sort of purpose?
Well, we would. That was a special technique of destroying a chamber.
Yes.
You would put an explosive charge, and this would be a case when you might want to have an electrical system. That would depend on how much time you had. In a concussion charge in each corner, but as all these chambers had an entrance to them. You had to have block the entrance off to stop the blast going out.
Yes.
And that was usually quite simple. A length of hessian with a wooden bar at the top and the bottom fastened above the entrance and one at the bottom. That hessian would be enough to stop the blast ways.
Well, that simple hessian would just tamp the blast
It had a very useful effect.
And it would collapse the chamber then?
Yeah, then the chamber would collapse. Otherwise, the blast would just simply fly out the hole. But that was a sort of variation on a theme like that. You always try and make sure that the blast will do what it's supposed to do and not just go out into the air.
How much warning did you have that your tour of duty in Korea was going to come to an end?
You were told at the beginning that you were there for a year and a half, 2 years at the most. And then the rule came in that you would do one winter. That was the idea, and where possible. And infantry units were rotated by units.
Yes.
And that their tour of duty would be timed, if where possible, to cover one winter. In the early days, of course, there was no such thing. And people often had, some of the early boys had 2 winters as much as, which was pretty difficult for them. But that was that position. Now, the gunners, they, like the sappers, we trickle posted.
Yes.
And so the unit would tend to stay, and people would then go at the end of their time, at the end of their reservist period, or after they completed a winter. Unless they were in a key position where they might be asked to stay a bit longer. It varied. But the idea was that one winter was enough. And it also, at the same time, gave more and more units and more people experience of what was going on there and giving them wartime combat experience, if you like. So it fulfilled 2 functions like that.
Did you know in advance what you were going to be doing next after you'd finished in Korea?
No. I came back and went on leave. And then a posting order came, sent me to Aldershot.
Had you had any leave while you were in the theatre?
Yes, I had. I was lucky. I had 2 5-day R&R in Tokyo.
What would you do when you went to Tokyo? What would the...
You don't seriously want me to tell you that, do you?
Only if you'd really want to.
It was tremendous fun. I mean, you were you waited quite a long time for your leave, generally, the first one. 5 days wasn't a long time. And you flew, by that time there was a flying system from Kimpo Airfield near Seoul, straight to Tokyo. We were extremely lucky that there was a leave camp, the embassy leave camp, but that was mainly for soldiers in those days. we went to the Marunouchi Hotel in Tokyo, which was a very, very nice hotel, which had been commandeered by the Australians early on in the occupation, because they were the prime force in the BCOF, the British Commonwealth Occupation Forces of Japan.
Yes.
And they had a very nice setup. And we had a luxury hotel, and you had 5 days, including travel there and travel back, just to have a hell of a time.
So it was a five-day party.
A five-day party, yes. It was great fun, and quite a change, complete change from what you've been doing before, which was, I think, the main thing. To call it R&R, rest and recuperation, was perhaps a misnomer.
Perhaps rest and rioting would be
something like that.
It was or rioting and rampaging.
A pretty hilarious time, anyway.
What about in Korea itself? Did you get any opportunity to see anything of Korea other than the areas where the fighting was going on?
No, I really didn't. Just we knew our local area, the part that we had been and moved, and that wasn't overall a very big part of it. The only times were when I went down and did my stint at the battle camp in Japan, and I travelled by train down, but one didn't see too much of the country there. The opportunity of seeing or getting an overall impression of the whole country was so limited, almost to be zero.
And you mentioned the winter. It said that the winters in Korea were exceptionally severe and difficult. Did you manage to make yourself comfortable?
We made ourselves as comfortable as we could, and I think we succeeded very well. We could quickly build ourselves, and we had tents, of course, which were okay, but in the winter they didn't provide much protection. But we improvised heating devices, and there was a plenty of timber around for fires. And then the Americans supplied us with these petrol-fired space heaters. I don't think I mentioned those. They were issued quite liberally, and it was a sort of drip feed of petrol into the thing, and that burned and threw out quite a lot of heat. They were inherently dangerous, and there were quite a number of accidents, some fatal, of people mishandling space heaters and using fuel to keep themselves warm in various ways. There were some quite serious accidents that way.
Was there anything you could do to modify those devices to make them safer?
Not really, no. You just had to use them with and follow the instructions. Mm. But no, having said that, they were still inherently dangerous, and you had to be very careful. Mm. But when they worked very well.
What about your clothing and your boots and so forth? Were they adequate for the winter conditions?
They became adequate. We didn't really get much in the way of winter equipment until the end, more than halfway through my first winter. Mm. That was 1951. Up till that time, we had battle dress, we had our boots, ammunition, although I had I used my own pair of Veltschirn, which were very popular at that time. They were exceptionally good, but they wore out in Korea, I have to say, with the amount of walking we did. The only thing we had in addition was one of the early woolly pullovers with a drawstring around the neck and a string vest or two. And they were actually string vests made of string. That was how they got their name, and now they're made of other things. But the idea was you wore a string vest, your shirt, khaki flannel, and a pullover, and a battle dress top. And then that was barely adequate. Then during the winter of 51-52, certainly must have been nearly Christmas time or thereabouts, I can't remember exactly, the cold weather kits started to come in, and we had the green cold combat suits, rather like these. But yes, very
like
much
sort of
like this.
Looks like a denim material you're wearing.
Yeah.
Yes.
But they were shower proof.
Yes.
We had long johns. The underwear we were issued with long johns, which I still have. Use them for fishing now. And the string vest we kept, slightly better pullover, and then we had these blue original green combat jackets, which were exactly like that. And then we had our scarves out of this camouflage material, you know, for your face.
Yes.
Which
face veil,
that sort of thing.
Yes.
Which you as a neck scarf.
Yes.
And then we were given parkas, which were fur lined, artificial fur lined, that sort of material. But they were very warm, and they had a hood, which you could bring right over, and the hood had a wire frame, so you could actually bring it right down, and make it straight there down. And straight there and down, so you could just have the minimum to see out.
Just have your eyes.
A loose hood, you know, is
yes.
Unless you've got a drawstring. But the wire frame that was very flexible, I mean, you could reduce the face exposure to the minimum for operating, particularly at night. And it also had a very good thing at a tail with a strap which you could bring through here and button up. Which kept you additionally warm and allow you to sit down too with some comfort. But when it came, the cold weather kit was good. And then we got boots, cold wet weather. They were known as cobbly wobblies. And they had a thick rubber sole. And then we had insoles. And that was a great improvement for keeping you wet and keeping your feet warm. And in the cold, wet weather, and also the cold, snowy weather. And as a result of that, I had no incidents of frostbite or foot rot in my troop, and I don't think many people did.
What about the supply of food, and hot food in particular? Was that well maintained?
Very, very well maintained. We lived on our own British rations, which were very popular. And we had the composite rations and the compo. We also got a lot of American rations, and their C rations, which were an improvement on the wartime K rations, was a pack, and it contained perhaps a couple of tins of chicken noodles or hamburgers or hash meat or something like that. An oatmeal cake, a bar of chocolate, toilet paper, a packet of 20 cigarettes and matches, and some tea and powdered milk. For certain times and operations, you got those. And if you were away from your base for a while, you were self-supporting. So we had a mixture of fresh rations and compo. American rations were very popular, particularly their ham and their turkey, fresh ham, fresh turkey. But I personally, I think many others did too, found them rather rich. And we were quite happy to revert to our ordinary British rations. But food was never a problem. Keeping it warm was a problem in the winter. But I can't remember being short of food, and plenty of tea. Not much coffee in those days, although I think the C ration had a little coffee in it. But tea was the usual. Have we time for a brew up? Yes, that's the sort of thing. Yeah, but the rations were adequate, very adequate. Never felt hungry. We had a fair supply of beer, Japanese Asahi beer, which came up in bottles, I think. That was a fairly hefty strain on the logistical chain. And a ration of small ration of whiskey and gin.
Did you normally live in an officer's mess when you weren't actually in the line, or
no,
were you living with the unit?
I lived with my troop.
Yes.
And part of the time I had a troop officer, part of the time I was on my own.
Mm. Did you tend to cook for yourself, or did you have
the troop had a central cooking place.
Yes.
And I would just have my meat, my meal on a plate in my tent when I'd be making up notes or getting ready to give. Having been to squadron headquarters and got my orders for the day, I was busy writing those up to pass on to my section commanders and so on.
Were your groups normally held in the morning or at night?
At night. At the end of the day, you reported on what you had done during the day, although that was just four.